From Mississippi to New York, Idaho to Florida, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the 2020 U.S. Prosperity Index has been released by the Lagotham Institute. Sean Flanagan is here with details on the nation's economic progress. Congress and the Trump administration are engaged in negotiations over what will be included in the fourth COVID-19 relief package. Scott Parkinson of the Club for Growth has the real story. Price gouging has been a problem, as some have sought to profit from the pandemic. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Ryan Young from the Competitive Enterprise Institute about why existing laws have not been effective in curbing that abuse. And statue toppling has become a national obsession. How long will it be before statues honoring religious figures are next? Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Each year, the Lagotham Institute produces its U.S. Prosperity Index. The index tracks a wide range of prosperity indicators. It breaks that data down to the state and even the county level. Here with details from the 2020 index is Sean Flanagan. Sean is director of the Center for Metrics at the Lagotham Institute. Sean, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Sean, tell us about the 2020 U.S. Prosperity Index. What is the index and what is it that you are measuring?
We're trying to measure prosperity. And by prosperity, we mean the combination of both economic and social well-being. And it's both of those needing to be present to lead to a life truly flourishing. And so what we've developed globally over the past 13 years at the Institute is an index which captures that for 167 countries around the world and how that's changed over the past decade. When we look at the global index, we see that on the economic aspects of the index, the US does really well. It ranks fourth on the open economies domains. There's three domains in the index: open economies, inclusive societies, and empowered people. And on the open economies, the US ranks fourth out of 167 nations, so it does very well. But when you look at inclusive societies and empowered people, it ranks 27th and 21st, respectively, and we wanted to understand why. So we developed the United States Prosperity Index, which measures the prosperity across the 50 states of the Union and DC and how that's changed over the past decade. And in the latest release, we've also extended the index to include county index for eight selected states. That's capturing prosperity across 829 counties in these eight states.
You mentioned that there are disparities within the country among states. Can you elaborate a little bit more on that? Are there particular states that you're seeing on this prosperity index that are doing well, that are the all-stars? Tell us a bit about those states. And then also, which states seem to be lagging behind the nation as a whole?
What we see through the state-level index is that there is, broadly speaking, a sort of north-south divide. So we generally see those states in the north of the U.S. performing better than those in the south, and particularly those in the northeast are the strongest performing states, but not universally true. So we also see the likes of Utah and Colorado and Washington State doing well. But then the states in the south, around sort of Mississippi, Louisiana, Arkansas, they're the ones that perform the weakest on prosperity.
And is there any common theme as to why the southern states are not doing quite as well? Is this a matter of public policy at the state level? What's at play here?
It varies, really. I mean, I think that's the beauty of the index, is it's very much showing at a state level and now at the county level for those where we have data, what are the strengths and weaknesses of each area? And what we've seen through the index is that there are some states that underperform in a particular area, and there will be another state that performs well in that area. And we believe there's an opportunity for collaboration and sharing exchanging ideas and policy initiatives to help apply things that have worked elsewhere. They may also work in a different state to address particular weaknesses.
You mentioned in the report, or the report mentions, that while personal freedom has been improving around the country, there's been a decline in social capital. Can you explain what you mean by the term social capital, and why is that decline important?
Social capital really is like the glue of society. What sort of it's the strength of relationships and trust that holds society together. And what we've seen in the index is that over the past decade, that's deteriorated across the U.S. And the U.S. is not alone in this. The United Kingdom has seen a similar decline. And what we see there is particularly around social networks. That's the sort of interactions with neighbors, regularly sort of engaging, helping neighbors, but also trust in institutions, trust in the federal government, trust in the media and corporations. And then finally, the civic and social participation. That's the extent to which people are engaged in society and active in society, you know, participation in clubs, religious organizations, but also volunteering. We've seen those three areas deteriorate, which is a worrying sign because that isn't those sort of relationships and trust are important for society. But we have seen an improvement over that time in the strength of personal and family relationships. So they're the ones that are sort of closest to us. They haven't weakened to the same extent. But the decline in social capital is fairly universal across the U.S. I think it's only 8 or 9 states that haven't seen a decline. So that would seem to be more of a macro problem that should need to be addressed.
You also reference the fact that the United States, Sean, underperforms in areas such as safety, security, health, and living conditions. And you say this is a barrier to future growth, future aspiration. Why is that?
So I think on health, what we have seen on health is overall health has improved over the past decade, which is good. Again, there are state-level differences, which the index can help illuminate. But one of the areas that has seen a deterioration is mental health. So whilst health overall has improved, mental health has declined. And that's a result of an increase in drug overdose deaths and suicides, serious mental illness also increasing. And that's a concern, particularly as the U.S. headed into the pandemic, as people are worried about their jobs, as jobs are lost, but also just general anxiety about the index. I know you guys are going through a tough time at the moment with a sort of resurgence in some states. That creates anxiety, can actually exacerbate the decline in mental health. Similarly, in education, we have seen an improvement over the past decade, which is great. But over the latest year, we saw a deterioration in test scores at a sort of grade 4 and grade 8 level. And that again, is a concern as, you know, school closures would have undoubtedly taken place during the pandemic. And what has been the impact on education? Are we going to see that has deteriorated further? So there are some worrying signs, whilst overall the U.S. heading into the pandemic, prosperity was at highest ever level and had been growing over the past decade. So we believe it put the U.S. in a good position, but there are some warning signs like those we've just talked through.
We have been talking with Sean Flanagan. Sean is director of the Center for Metrics at the Legotham Institute. Sean, tell us a bit about the Legotham Institute and also give us a website where folks can go if they want to delve more deeply into the 2020 Prosperity Index.
So the Legotham Institute was founded about 13, 14 years ago with a mission to help create the pathways from poverty to prosperity. And initially that was globally. And in order to do that, we wanted a way of measuring and understanding where nations were currently to identify these strengths and weaknesses. So we developed the Global Prosperity Index. So that's something that we use with nations around the world. And in terms of the U.S., so all of the information on the U.S. is fully open source, and it can be accessed via our website, which is www.usprosperity.net. And there is a profile for every single state in D.C., and then also for each of these 829 counties and 8 selected states.
Sean Flanagan from the Legotham Institute. Sean, thank you for taking time to be with us.
Thanks very much for having me on, Lohman.
Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth joins us each week here on American Radio Journal. A lot has been happening this summer in Congress. He continues to track that as more congressional action is expected over the next couple of weeks. Scott, good to have you here.
Great to be back, Lohman. Thank you.
Now we have Congress, as I said, back in session. They are considering what will be included in what will likely be the fourth stimulus package or fourth package in reaction to the COVID-19 crisis. Scott, give us some idea as to what it is that the members are considering here.
Yeah, so right now, this week, it's really been a Republican negotiation. Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi basically threw their hands up to Larry Kudlow and Mark Meadows and Steve Mnuchin and said, hey, we're not going to negotiate with you until we know exactly what your position is. So Republicans went to the drawing board and came up with a proposal that largely continues a lot of the programs from the CARES Act and also is missing some big details that the White House has been pushing for since May.
In terms of those details from the CARES Act and continuing them, would that include things like extending the unemployment compensation benefits, the $600 a week, the Paycheck Protection Program? Would those items be included in this discussion?
The unemployment insurance extended benefit program that throws another $600 on top of what the state uninsurance program gives those that are unemployed is on the table for the negotiations with the Democrats. I think what we're seeing is a back and forth, not to offer that full $600 that the Democrats want, but Republicans are coming in with a lower number. And in the end, will probably result somewhere between $300 and $400 per week. Now, that's still a pretty generous federal benefit. That's all on top of what states are giving the unemployed through their own programs. So it's still paying a lot of people not to work. And even if it's not more than 100% of your salary, if you're not working and you're sitting home and you're making a large percentage, there's still this disincentive to get back in the workforce, especially for those hourly workers that really seem to be lagging in terms of rejoining the economy. So we're watching that element very, very closely. With the Paycheck Protection Program, Republicans wanted to see that extended. Marco Rubio has been working with Senator Cardin on a plan that would effectively extend the Paycheck Protection Program for round two for folks that have previously received it, but they would extend this new program to folks that were seeing really about 50% in revenues and less than, I think, 300 employees. So it's going to have some different thresholds than what we saw in the previous two iterations of the PPP, but we do expect that to be something in the negotiations that the Democrats will allow once we begin negotiating with Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer in earnest. You know, a couple of the big things, back in May, Donald Trump said, listen, I'm not doing anything else unless I get a payroll tax cut. The bottom line is, this week, Steve Mnuchin caved on those negotiations, even with the Republican Senate, and they are not including that provision at all in phase four. So that, I know, is disappointing for many employers that wanted to see the employer and employee side of the payroll tax eliminated or at least reduced during this coronavirus pandemic. In addition to that, we're seeing another round of the Trump stimulus checks. I would expect the Republican offer to be the exact same thresholds, meaning you would get the full benefit, $1,200 check at $75,000 for individuals, and that would phase out to $0 at $100,000 for your annual income. For joint filers, it would phase out between $150,000 and $200,000. So that's the same thresholds that we saw in the previous round of those Trump stimulus checks. Additionally, Republicans are offering billions and billions of dollars for testing and other health programs. So it does turn into being another trillion-dollar package. And quite frankly, this is money that we do not need to be spending right now, brand new money. When you look at the previous iterations of the coronavirus pandemic stimulus spending, about half of that money still remains and hasn't been allocated or obligated. So we think that there's certainly $1 trillion remaining. You had this big bucket of $500 billion for corporations and large businesses that largely has been unspent because many corporations don't want it to be public that they didn't have the liquidity to make ends meet. So if it became public, what would happen with their stock prices? Their stock prices would just plummet. And so I don't think people have really been taking advantage of that program either. So we continue to kind of watch what happens now that the Democrats will get a seat at the table and what they'll ask for. I think that there will be additional requests for housing financial assistance. They'll probably try to rig elections through mail-in ballots, and they'll just add on money for state and local governments and blue states that have been irresponsibly run for a generation. So really, we have a lot of concerns about how phase four is coming together. Obviously, the negotiations continue. But meanwhile, we have another big issue on our hands, and that's the reopening of schools.
And while Congress grapples with all of these issues at the local level, Scott, many school districts are trying to decide whether or not to open their classrooms. What is the status and the guidelines at this point for school reopenings?
Largely, the liberal teachers' unions have been dominating the posture in public education. Now that we're ramping back up for this next school year, I think that a lot of school districts are picking 100% virtual learning and not allowing children back inside the classroom. And really, that is a failure of leadership at the public education level. You're seeing some private schools, and obviously homeschooling is becoming an attractive option. So we would certainly support giving students and families the option to transition either into a public charter school, a private school, or homeschooling, and letting those federal education dollars follow the parent and the student into alternative school choice rather than really just giving all this money to public school districts that really are closed and failing our students right now.
We have been talking with Scott Parkinson. Scott, of course, with the Club for Growth. And Scott, tell us a bit about the club.
The Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of our nation's capital. We are very much advocating on behalf of our membership for a limited government that supports economic opportunity and liberty and freedom. And if your listeners are interested in checking us out, our website is clubforgrowth.org. And our Twitter handle is @ClubForGrowth with the number 4.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. We'll check in next week for another status update. Thank you.
Thanks.
Price gouging. It happens even during a pandemic as some seek to profit from the misfortune of others. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Ryan Young from the Competitive Enterprise Institute about why current laws have not been effective.
Anytime there is a natural disaster or certainly a pandemic, you see people that are trying to make a quick buck by charging more than they normally would for some basic products. It's what we call price gouging, and it's one of those things that tends to get people pretty upset, and understandably so. But the real question is, what's the best way to respond to this sort of behavior in the marketplace? Is it something that requires a law and government enforcement, or is it something that can be worked out without all of that? Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is an expert in some of these questions. His name is Ryan Young. He's a senior fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, a friend of the program who's been here several times before, and also the author of a new report looking at the effectiveness of anti-price gouging laws. You can find that report at CEI.org. Ryan, thanks for taking some time and joining us here once again.
Thanks so much, Eric.
Ryan, we see these calls for anti-price gouging laws all the time after things like hurricanes and floods, and we've seen it again during the pandemic here. State lawmakers, members of Congress, even Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross have all kind of floated the idea that there need to be stricter enforcement here. Let's start with, I think, the main reason why people argue for these laws is infuriating circumstances like one that happened a few weeks ago. I know this seems like it was probably years ago now, but it was right at the beginning of the pandemic. There were these two brothers in Tennessee or Kentucky, somewhere over there, they drove around to a bunch of grocery stores and pharmacies in their area. They bought up as much hand sanitizer as they possibly could, and they had this brilliant idea. They were going to resell it online and make a killing. Classic example of what we would call price gouging, but it didn't exactly work out for them.
No, it didn't. They hoarded a total of 17,700 bottles of hand sanitizer, and they wanted to sell them on Amazon for as high as $70 a bottle. Amazon's algorithm shut them down within a day. There was a public outcry. The authorities got involved. And while they ended up not having to deal with any charges or any jail time, they did end up giving away all of their hand sanitizer to charities. And in the community, now their name is basically mud. So if people want to fight price gouging, I would say legislation isn't quite necessary. I think social norms are an overlooked part of keeping prices in check where possible during an emergency.
Yeah, and of course, we do see prices go up during an emergency for basic goods. That's just an effect of the market, and that makes people mad. When economists talk about price gouging laws, they say things like, well, banning price gouging is inefficient, and I totally agree with that. But I'm not sure that really connects with people who see something happening that is obviously wrong and they want that to be fixed. But there are other ways, and in this report, you go into some of the other ways to understand the dynamics at play here. There's some of what we might call hidden prices or trade-offs at play as well.
Prices are more than money. They're also non-money prices, time spent waiting in line, shipping times, maybe having to drive across the street to find something that your local store doesn't have, or drive across town to find something your local store doesn't have. These kinds of non-money prices are just as important. So if you clamp down on money prices during a shortage, prices can't go up to discourage people from buying. What you're going to find is that just like squeezing the air down on a balloon, the amount of air doesn't change. It just goes elsewhere. Here, it goes into non-money prices. Those become much worse than they otherwise would. And legislation essentially shoehorns people into only that kind of price increase. For people who don't want that kind of price mix of money and non-money prices, that does them no favors, and especially during a crisis when people have to lock down for, we're in what, month four of this now, price gouging laws are inflexible and really not helping people. Yeah, we had empty shelves for a few weeks in places like Venezuela. They're empty on a permanent basis. Things aren't perfect, but they're a lot better than they could be. And the way the market responded was admirable. I mean, to deal with the face mask shortage, companies were redirecting from whole other lines of work. There's a drumhead manufacturer called Evans. They went from making musical equipment over to using the same kind of plastic to make face masks for healthcare workers. That's the sort of thing you see happening. And I think that's very heartening. There's not necessarily legislation that can do that.
We're talking with Ryan Young from the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Ryan, I want to finish up here just by asking about the enforceability of price gouging laws, because price gouging is one of those things that does happen from time to time. You're never going to really stop it. And it sort of creates this incentive, this response from people to say, well, there ought to be a law. But as you point out here in this report, private companies can really see this and respond to this much more quickly than the government can. And I think this is an area where that sort of speed and response really does matter.
Yeah, people just don't like price gouging, and companies are responding to that. Amazon uses a combination of artificial intelligence algorithms, as well as having employees manually police their third-party sellers. So if they find something off that looks to them like price gouging, they can shut down that online store and penalize the merchant. Of course, this also backfired, kind of like legislation can. For example, the algorithm detects a lot of false positives to the point where sellers who didn't want their reputations and their ratings on the site going sour would actually just stop selling emergency supplies altogether because they didn't want to get nicked by the algorithm. But of course, unlike legislation, Amazon can change its algorithm anytime it wants to.
Yeah, of course. I mean, you've got Amazon. They can detect and respond to this sort of thing long before somebody can file a complaint with the Federal Trade Commission or the Commerce Department, somebody like that. That whole bureaucratic process, you can imagine that taking months to play out. Amazon can just say, nope, price gouging, you're off the marketplace until you correct it. And if Amazon makes a mistake, they can more quickly correct that mistake too than the federal government can, of course. But we are unfortunately out of time for today. We can't gouge a little more time out of the program here. Ryan, thanks for taking some time and joining us.
Thank you, Eric.
And that is Ryan Young. He is a senior fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Check out his new report on how anti-price gouging laws would harm the COVID-19 response at CEI.org. I am Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Head on over to Reason.com to check out everything we are working on. And you can catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Statues commemorating the lives of those who have had a significant impact on religion in America could be among the next to be toppled as the cancel culture continues to prosper. So says Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College on this American Radio Journal commentary.
Confederate generals, Union generals, Columbus, George Washington, Francis Scott Key, Churchill, whose statue is next? They've come for generals and presidents and prime ministers. When will they come for saints? Answer, they already have. In fact, his name is Saint Junipero Serra. Serra was a founder of California, an unappreciated pioneer of this nation. The 18th century Spanish Franciscan built the famous mission churches throughout the state. He also built Christianity. California cities have saint names because of Sarah's missionaries. San Francisco, St. Francis. Santa Clara, St. Clair. Santa Barbara, Ventura, which is named for St. Bonaventure. And right now in the city of Ventura, they're taking down the giant statue of St. Junipero Serra outside City Hall. Serra's critics have denounced him for bringing Christianity to the native population in the first place. Moreover, they've done nothing short of link him to genocidal racism. Says one activist, Ben Leaños of nearby Camarillo, quote, "We've been seeing around the country and the world statues of racist and genocidal people being taken down, and we think it's time that happens in Ventura." Not coincidentally, Ventura's decision comes as news arrives of revolutionaries in San Francisco's Golden State Park pulled down a statue of Serra there, a stoic monument of the man holding a life-size crucifix. Serra was a victim there along with General Ulysses S. Grant, the Union general who, ironically, defeated the Confederacy during the Civil War before going to battle against the KKK and fighting for the right of black Americans to vote. Yes, seriously. Likewise, Serra was toppled at Father Serra Park in Los Angeles. In fact, they are literally out for Junipero Serra's head throughout California. In September 2017, the Serra statue outside the Santa Barbara Mission was splashed with red paint and beheaded. All of which makes me wonder what Pope Francis would think of this. Not exactly a white nationalist flying the stars and bars from his pickup truck. Francis canonized Junipero Serra in September 2015 while in Washington, D.C. He said that Serra not only did not mistreat Native Americans, but, quote, sought to defend the dignity of the Native community, protecting those who had been mistreated and abused, unquote. Los Angeles Archbishop Jose Gomez seconds Francis's high praise, saying that Serra had, quote, deep love for the Native peoples that he had come to evangelize, and said some truly remarkable things about human dignity, human rights, and the mercy of God, unquote. Archbishop Gomez rightly hails Serra as an overlooked American founder. Especially significant, he says, quote, remembering St. Junipero reminds us that America's first beginnings were not political, they were spiritual, unquote. Good point. That was true not only of the religious people who landed on the East Coast, from Columbus to the Mayflower Pilgrims, but of Serra and all those on the West Coast. Unfortunately, these sentiments will not assuage the attackers. To the contrary, it's that very religious patrimony that some militate against. Many Americans initially thought that statue attacks were expressions of righteous anger at Confederate symbols. I got news for you. We're way beyond that. In fact, what's next? Well, I hate to give the revolutionaries any ideas, but I'm reminded of a favorite stop of mine in Ventura, a town that I've actually visited many times. There's a large cross erected by Father Serra above the city over 200 years ago. It's called the Serra Cross. I wonder, will it get the noose, the saw, the spray can, and why not? After all, that cross is the very symbol of the evangelical efforts of Junipero Serra and his missions. How long before the mob demands the cross come down, too? For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor. Check out my book, A Pope and a President, on Pope John Paul II and President Ronald Reagan.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including KTLX-FM in Columbus, Nebraska, WMBS-AM and FM in Uniontown, Pennsylvania, along with KWFM-FM in Wichita Falls, Texas. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.